I'll just say we're here at UCF speaking to the Jewish students here about, you know, the life and times of Chaim Kanievsky and well, maybe how it relates to the Parsha. Let me just preface with one general idea. What's the cutoff point for a generation? Now, you always, when you say it's the end of an era, you always have people that, you know, cross that line, live past that line. So what tells you that, you know, this is where the generation ends? Yeah. You know, sure, you have people that, you know, are only halfway through their lives at that time that you want to say is the cutoff point where a certain generation ended, another generation began. What determines that? You know, we have this concept in Judaism. You know, the first mission of us, Moshe Kibel Torah Misinai, Masrul Yoshua, Yoshua Skenim. There's an era called the Skenim, the elders. Skenim Linevium. There was an era called the era of the prophets, which is on a different level, right? Nevi'im Masrul Anshe Knesset Sagdola, and then, you know, they passed on to another era. Post-prophecy, the men of the Great Assembly, who were, you know, that was the Beth Din of Ezra, you know, at the time, the beginning of the Second Commonwealth. And then after that, we have eras, Tanoim, who, you know, which is really the era of the Mishnah. Then the Amoraim, which is the era of the Talmud. And then there's the post-Talmudic era. We also have Gaonim, Rishonim, Achronim. Yeah. How do we decide, you know, on what basis? Anyway, they say a generation ended and a different generation started. Right? So the answer lays that, you know, both in the individual and the generation. You know, just put it in the words of the Baal Shem Tov. Where is a person? Where is a person? Where his thoughts are? Not where a person is, it may be in today's jargon, say it's where his heart is, but it means, you know, where a person's center of attention is. That's really what determines his level. Say one guy is a loftier individual than another guy, right? And they both, you know, daven three times a day, and they both keep kosher, and they both keep Shabbos, right? Ideally, all, in an ideal world, all Jews should equally keep Jewish law equally. So what makes one person, as it were, holier or loftier than the other? Right? The loftier person, his thoughts are in a loftier place. His concepts, what he values, what he cares about, right? You know, he's on a higher mental plane, and therefore on a higher spiritual plane, because perception is reality. If he has higher perceptions, he's in a higher place in reality. You know, the Rambam in the Mor Nevuchim says an amazing thing that, you know, even in the individual, this could fluctuate. And the Rambam writes that when a person has God on his mind, well, at the time that he has God on his mind, and he's real with the fact that God is everywhere and God, you know, controls the whole world, at those moments, the person is impervious to harm. Doesn't have to worry about getting hit by a bus or being attacked by a wild animal, right? And a person, you know, could actually, God forbid, forget about God, like totally be oblivious that there's a God and behaves it that way. During those moments, says the Rambam, the person's totally vulnerable. Totally vulnerable. Right. So even in the individual, this could fluctuate, but overall, where a person's head is, that's where he is. Right. When we set, you know, sort of cutoff points in generations, we say from this point onwards, a critical mass of people no longer think the same way. That's why we say it's a different generation. I heard a frightening thing. I was amongst the many things I did in my eclectic teaching career. So I taught in a girls' school in Jerusalem, Michlala. You heard of it? Michlala and Bayit Vegan. It's a pretty well-known seminary. The founder once addressed us. He was retired at the time. I don't know if he's still alive. No, he's not, Rabbi Cooperman. He addressed us once, and amongst the things that he said, his tips for teaching, there was just one thing that's really stuck with me. He said that, a generation doesn't understand the next generation. You know, our parents complain that they just don't understand what we're thinking. We don't understand them. And this reinforces the point that when you think differently, that's the cutoff point between generations. And he said a very funny thing in this world, in the world of today, and this was quite a while ago, you know, every 5 years is a new generation. Every 5 years is a new generation, you know, because ideas and values are changing so rapidly. Right? But there could be like an event that happens that causes a generational shift, because there are certain people, you know, so you've probably heard the term Gadol Hador, right, which was said about Rav Chaim, the great one of the generation. This ties into what we're saying. There are certain individuals that they're like the beacon. They're like the lighthouse. They're like the our anchor, our true north, that we arrange the way we think and the way we feel following their lead, following their lead. So he's not just an individual. He is the setting the tone, right, and being the signpost, right, being the map, being the compass for a whole generation. So he's like literally the leader of the generation. And once he's gone, we've lost our compass. We've lost our map. We've lost our lighthouse. We've lost our true north. It was the Gadol Hador. Now there's, sorry to say, a real generational shift, all right, because there was no one like him, you know, by our standards, a man that was 100% Torah and nothing else, really. And he was our true north, right? And he wasn't a politician. He wasn't a motivational speaker, and he wasn't a political leader. He was just pure Torah. And that was his amazing appeal that everyone, you know, the whole generation shook. Right? What still brings tears to my eyes, I hope I don't lose it over here, you know, is that in Israel, you know, even the sports teams, people were totally secular, you know, wore black ribbons, and by a Beitar game, that's a leading soccer team, there was a huge banner, right? We feel the pain over the loss of the Gadol Hador. Secular Israel, he's talking about, you know, that the whole generation was somehow, you know, tied in. He was setting, you know, our moral compass, right? Our intellectual bearings. And really, so sometimes you have the Gadol Hador, the great one of the generation, that when he leaves, it's a whole generational shift. Right? Because how everyone, you know, whether consciously or subconsciously, is influenced by his guidance and by the light that he says, like, you know, the lighthouse, that everyone, even the people close to the lighthouse or far away from the lighthouse, all set their bearings, you know, relative to that lighthouse. And that's, you know, that's what he was. I want to just say a few words of Torah. You know, we're in a very, interesting year, you know, a Jewish leap year. We had an extra Adar, you had to wait an extra month for Purim, right? Yeah. And that's for the, it's supposed to be a very holy year, because we're engaged in trying to attain cosmic balance between the lunar cycle and the solar cycle, you know, because, you know, we have to balance these two. And the disbalance between these two cycles, you know, represents the rift that there is in the cosmos that we have to put right. So the year of, a leap year, of a Chodesh Shana Mu'beres, is a very holy year. I'll tell you something that says in the writings of the Vilna Gaon, you know, that the solar cycle lags behind the lunar cycle by 10 days. The lunar cycle is 355 days. Gematria Shana, the numerical value of actually the word year, 355. Right? That's the lunar cycle that we count by. The solar cycle is 10 days longer, 365. Right? So now, you know, every year is ushered in with Rosh Hashanah on the lunar cycle. And the solar cycle lags behind another 10 days. When does the solar cycle catch up to the lunar cycle? That should be in the same year, because the lunar cycle turned a year on Rosh Hashanah, right? So it became 5782 on Rosh Hashanah on the lunar cycle. The solar cycle was still in 5781. When did it catch up? On Yom Kippur, on the Day of Atonement. Because Yom Kippur is all about fixing what's wrong with the cosmos, and that's the day where the solar cycle catches up to the lunar cycle. Says the Vilna Gaon, the 30 days of the second Adar are built out of three sets of Aseres Yemei Tshuva. So that's why every third year we go through three times of Aser Simei Tshuva, right? Equals Adar Sheni, the big year, where we pull the two cycles together. So it's like Yom Kippur all year round. The 30 days of Adar Sheni were accumulated by three sets of Aser Simei Tshuva. Right? It's a very big year. So let's look for the unique connection that in this year, you know, Parshas Parah, the supplementary reading we're going to read this upcoming Shabbos, fits together with Parshas Shemini, which talks about the story of, you know, the inauguration of the Mishkan, right? But there was a big tragedy that happened on that day. There weren't that many Kohanim in the world. There were five Kohanim: Aaron, Nadav, Avil, Elazar, and Isamar. There were five Kohanim. That's all there were, right? On this day, Nadav and Avil, who meant well, you know, they went in and they offered a foreign fire that God didn't, you know, authorize, and they were consumed. And we lost two out of our five Kohanim, a very big tragedy. And Moshe indeed says, the Jewish people are going to mourn this terrible fire that Hashem burned. It was a big tragedy. They meant well, but they erred, right? You know, and there's I think, an amazing measure, aside from the fact that how Am Yisrael mourned for Nadav and Avihu, who were, you know, two out of our five Kohanim, definitely from our holier class of people, right? A big tragedy. And the Pasuk most definitely is apropos to our losing of Rav Chaim Kanievsky. Right? But I think there's an interesting message that puts it together with Parshas Parah, and everyone knows that the Parshas Parah, we read the laws of the Parah Aduma, the red heifer, that is the one thing that could take off the impurity caused by death. Now, there's something else that Chazal tell us about Parah Aduma, right, that there's some halachas about it that defy logic, that we can't understand. Right, the ashes, you know, mixed with water, will take off the impurity of the guy who's in, but the guy who actually sprinkles himself is impure, and has to, you know, go to the mikveh and wait till, you know, the next day. You know, so if you think the source of purity, so the guy, the pure person, should be purity squared. And it's not that way, right? It's and there are other things about it that we don't understand. And Hashem tells Moshe, they should take to you the Parah Aduma, bring it to you, which we have to understand why. But one of the things that the Medrash says in that is, L'chani megale tamei Parah la'acherim chukah. Right, to you, I'm going to reveal all the reasons of Parah Aduma and how it works, and you're going to understand it. To everyone else, it'll remain a mystery. You know, what's the connection? You know, Parah Aduma, that takes off the impurity of death, it's a mystery to us, but to Moshe, it makes perfect sense. Right? One more question. Right, and that is that the, you know, when the Torah goes through the laws, what we're going to read, you know, the Torah describes, you know, that, you know, a person dies in the tent. Adam ki yomus bo, and when a person dies in the tent, so Chazal say a very interesting, you know, drasha on that, and say, yomus atzmo bala shatar, a person who dies in the tent refers to a person has to die in the tent of Torah. I mean, a person has to learn and learn and learn until, you know, he just drops. Right? He has to be willing to learn and learn and learn. You know, he has to exert himself to that extent. You know, totally like Rav Chaim Kanievsky, a man who learned 17 hours a day for 90 years straight. You know, it's and why is that alluded to in Parah Aduma? But you know, where did death start from? Where did it start from? You know, God did not create death. You know, he created the potential for death, but he didn't create death. Man created death when he ate from the tree of knowledge, right? What is the quid pro quo? Why does eating from a tree of knowledge make death? Our mortality came because man ate from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. So now, I don't know, you probably know that that which we call the tree of knowledge is, don't be confused, that's like calling, gender studies knowledge. You know, we don't mean, you know, it's, knowledge is not to be understood as, you know, necessarily, you know, something in the positive like knowledge of Torah. As the Rambam explains, also in the Mor Nevuchim, it's the very second chapter of the book. He says that a person once asked me, you know, You know, Adam went against God's will, ate from the tree, and before he was an ignorant animal running naked, right? And now he's a knowledgeable person that understands that he was naked and should be wearing clothes. Adam seemingly gained from his sin. How could that be? And the Rambam says the person totally misunderstood what we mean by knowledge of good and evil. Good and evil are not synonyms for truth and falsehood. Right? Truth is what is. Right? Falsehood is what isn't, and they're absolute terms. I mean, used to be, right? You know, truth. Yeah. Today they talk about my truth, your truth, right? But you know, we talk about MS, you know, in the Torah sense. Everyone knows the famous Drash Chazal, Aleph Mem Tov, the first letter of the Jewish alphabet, the middle and the last. I mean, it is what is. Beginning, middle, end. It is what is. MS is reality, sheker, right? You know, falsehood is what isn't. Right? Adam, before the sin, just thought in terms of what is and what isn't. Truth versus falsehood. In a world of truth, it's nothing to be ashamed of the body. In the words of the later Rishonim, you do mitzvahs with your body. Are you ashamed of your tefillin? Your tefillin are also made out of skin. Not made out of animal skin. You're not ashamed of it. You do mitzvahs with it. If a person lives in a world where he just sees truth, the body's nothing to be ashamed of because you see its tremendous potential to be a vehicle for the neshama to do mitzvahs because the neshama can't do mitzvahs without a body. You know, and anything that we would call bad or half truth, you know, in our jargon, you see it for what it is, and you see how it's empty. You see how it's really, really nothing. It's nothing, right? So there's what is versus what isn't, and those are absolute terms. So now, as opposed to the tree of knowledge, what is the other tree? The tree of life. Life is an absolute term. You know, people say the term half dead, you know, but you know there's no such thing. You're either dead or alive. Not either dead or alive. There's no such thing as being half alive or half dead. You're either dead or alive. Right? Our Torah is both called the Torah Chaim and Chaim, right? The Torah of life. It's also called Torah Semes, the Torah of truth. It's also called the Torah Chesed, elsewhere in Tanakh, the Torah of kindness. It is what is, and that is the true kindness. And that is life. These are absolute terms. What's good and bad? What's good and bad are relative terms. You really mean, you know, everything's got its, you know, a certain way you could like twist your head and look at what's positive about it. And now that, God forbid, you could, you know, twist the head the other way and see a downside to something that's true and necessary. You guys, you take the sciences, right? How do we prefer, you know, one scientific theory over another? So now, hey, we're not talking about when you could see something empirically in the telescope or in the microscope. We're not talking about that. Right? Obviously, you know, before they were just simply ignorant, and now you see the facts. And we're not talking about that. But let's talk about something a little bit more abstract. Let's talk about, you know, something that you can't actually put it in a microscope or a telescope. Talk about gravity as an example. And if I'm wrong, you guys correct me, right? Aristotle explained it his way, right? Came Newton, right, and said, if really Galileo, and then Newton finished it off, you know, listen, there's some stuff here. If you say like this and like this and like this, you know, certain things remain difficult. Like balls that are of two different weights will roll down an incline at the same speed. The heavier object does not fall faster, right? Which Aristotle's way he assumed, the way he understood it, right? You have certain things difficult, so we go with Newton, right? Well, we go with Newton, we have certain things still difficult. Science then comes with his theory. Now, the truth is, right? No one knows what gravity is, but if you explain it this way, you have 10 things remain difficult. If you explain it this way, only 5 things remain difficult. If you explain it this way, only 2 things remain difficult. Doesn't mean you have the truth. You have a more comfortable theory. So that's good versus evil, upside versus down. It is more comfortable to explain it this way than to explain it that way. What's the truth? We don't know the truth. You can't like put gravity under a microscope and see what it is. Right? A friend of mine told me a story, you know, about how a person used to win every contest to write a creative Dvar Torah. Right? It was a trick that the judges never caught. And he always won for like 10 years straight until he just got, it wasn't fun anymore to trick people. People are really that gullible. Right? I mean, you have to be intelligent to grab, you know, the trick. He had a trick. Right? He asked 500 questions. Seemingly 500 totally non-related questions. Answered them all with one answer. Here's the thing. The answer had no basis, not in text, not in precedent, not in logic, right? It was a ridiculous idea. But if this ridiculous idea that he concocted would be true, it would answer 500 questions. So the shallow-minded judges always say, it's an amazing thing, he answered 500 questions with one answer, right? Because that's the way the mind works. Beforehand, you had 500 difficulties. Now you only have one difficulty. The actual theory itself, right? The thing itself, right? But the mind, I only have one difficulty versus having the thing itself, the idea itself, versus the 500 questions that I had beforehand. Right? You know, the mind of good and evil that we went into, you know, is hopelessly relativistic, upside versus downside, right? And it's got nothing to do with what is really true and what isn't true, right? And that's, you know, and in that relativistic mind, right, it's not an absolute mind, evil can now infiltrate reality. Death doesn't really exist. What is death? A form of non-existence. Right, it's a form of non-existence, so it doesn't exist. It's not what is. Life is what is. Right? But we made it real to us because it goes back to this idea of perception is reality. If you're going to perceive it as being real, so you're going to react to it as if it's real, right? You'll behave. So it becomes artificially real because society responds to it as if it's real, right? We also know ourselves, right? You guys are medical students. I know I suffer from this. You know, you got a phobia. You know your biochemistry changes, even though the phobia's got no basis. But, you know, your adrenaline starts pumping, right? You get that damn insulin resistance as a result, and because of that, you can't lose weight, and it's all because of stress over things that don't really exist, right? But the problem is, perception is your reality. We mentioned before, God is real, God is everywhere, God's in absolute control, but if you want to forget about him, we mentioned the Rambam before, you're vulnerable. For you, it's as if there is no God. You're not under his protection because you've eliminated him from your perception. Right? That's what made death real. That's what made, you know, in the words of the Rambam, all the evils that we could think of, you know, God forbid, all the perversions that there are in the world, you know, before Adam ate from that tree, those things were like way off in the sub-theoretical realm, right? It was totally off his radar, right? Wasn't even like the type of stuff he would dream about, let alone do. It was not even stuff that he would even dream about. It was like so off the radar of perception, right? And then when he ate from the fruit, it all entered the realm of perception, initially potentially, that now it's possible to think of, and every generation regressively, not progressively, you know, thinks these things that now you're capable of thinking and starts not just thinking them, starts acting on those perceptions and makes those things real. You know, real to us. Yeah, Nadav and Avihu, who their intentions was totally for the sake of heaven, and it's alluded to in their names. Nadav means benevolence. They want to do more for God than what God actually asked for. Right, but the problem is the gift of the Torah is that we know exactly what God wants, not more, not less. Right? And the word Avihu means you are my father. Right? They just wanted to cling to God even more than what the halacha mandated. But it was a mistake, and the Medrash qualifies their sin, The same way it qualifies the sin of Adam and the sin of the golden calf. Ozvu das makom. They left the das, right, the knowledge and perception of God, which is was gifted to us with the Torah. And v'hochu achar dat, and they went after their own way of thinking, right? The gift of the Torah is that, you know, if we're oblivious, you know, to the way God views reality, he revealed it to us in the Torah. Right? He gave us his das, he gave us his perception, the way God sees reality, he gifted to us in the Torah. And if we internalize das, Torah, we see the reality the way God sees it, right? You know, their intention was noble, right? But they made a grave intellectual error. You can't outthink the Torah. You can't be more religious than the Torah. You can't be closer to God than what the Torah, than how the Torah says get close to him. But I'll tell you a secret. Not only because you guys came out, you know, at this late hour to hear me, because their intention was pure, they had rectification. The Zohar says that at the time that Pinchas was going to be zealous, right, and take out Zimri for his public promiscuity of taking, you know, that Midianite woman in front of everybody, he was so scared because he was going to do a, you know, pretty brave act, kill the Nasi, the president of Shevet Shimon, the whole tribe Shimon, in front of them. You know, it's like, it was, that was like, you know, a really gutsy thing to do. You know, he dropped dead from fear on the spot, right? And none of Inaviu's souls were in the area at the time and re-entered his body and reanimated him. So Pinchas was reanimated with the souls of none of Inaviu, right? And with that, he got up again, and he followed through, and he killed Zimri, right? Which caused the plague that was, you know, to abate, right? And you know, that's why the Zohar explains, that's why, you know, Pinchas got the gift that he wasn't a Kohen, he became a Kohen. You want to know the mechanics of it? Because now he had the souls of none of Inaviu, who were Kohanim, inside of him. So they got rectification because their intent was pure. It was an intellectual error, but they were of pure heart. The intent was pure. That's why he got rectification, right? And you know, Pinchas subsequently becomes Eliyahu HaNavi. And this is what it says in the writings of the Arizal, that Ana, when we say Ana Hashem Oshiana, or Ana Hashem Keni Avdecha, Ana, please God, Ana is an abbreviation, Eliyahu Nadav Aviv. Right? Right, they got their rectification because at least their intent was truly pure. Right? Not so much when the Jewish people made the golden calf. Right, when we were at Sinai and we said Na'aseh v'Nishma, we reattained immortality, the Gemara says. For a while, we were like Adam before the sin. Right, but then we fell into a parallel mistake. You know, Adam, you know, rebelled against God's perception and wanted to, you know, have his own perception of reality. The Jewish people were in a similar situation. Why'd they make the golden calf? They got scared. They panicked, right? Because they thought Moshe died, because they, by their calculation, erroneously, they thought he was supposed to be back. They thought he died up in heaven, right? And they were really worried that they wouldn't have a connection to God, so they reverted back to what they knew. They knew idolatry because, you know, so Moshe is gone. And they did it, you know, seemingly for altruistic reasons, because they wanted, but they went back to idolatry. They didn't, you know, they didn't fully appreciate that if the Torah outlawed graven images, it can't be the right thing to do. And they made the golden calf, right? And the Medrash, like we said, Medrash in this week's parasha qualifies their sin as the same thing as the sin of Adam. Azvu das makom, they abandoned the das, right, the perceptions of God, which is revealed by Torah, and went after their own das, right? And parallel to that, it brought back mortality, right? So now you understand the quid pro quo, right? That Parah Aduma that takes off the impurity of death is something that's beyond human understanding, right? Because death comes into the world because of human understanding as we know it, because of the biochemical consciousness that we are plagued with today, right? That sadly just regresses more and more with every generation as the leaders of generation, you know, pass on, and we don't have their das Torah, and the das of the generation shifts. So every generation thinks of new perversions. How many genders are we up to right now? Right. Would you guys ever pass a test on all the pronouns if you knew to know them Baal Peh, right, by heart? Right, never, right? Right? That's because, you know, the das is shifting, right? So of course, para aduma, which takes off the impurity of death, which means it restores you to the level of the Eitz HaChayim, of pre-sin, of course it's not understandable to the mentality that we have, right? Of course it's beyond our understanding, because it brings you power from that higher level that we detach from, that made us mortal. But now you know, that's why Moshe could understand it, because Moshe wasn't even on earth when the sin of the golden calf happened. Aside the fact that Moshe is pure Torah, but he had no part in the sin whatsoever. He was in heaven when the whole thing happened. Right? So he does, to him, Parah Aduma makes perfect sense, because he has a Torah mind. So he looks at it, yeah, sure, it makes sense. What's the problem? What's not to be understood? Right? So now you understand, you know, the gift of the Torah, right, is to that we should, you know, see things the way God himself sees it. He's the creator. This is reality according to the creator of reality himself, right? This is what's real. This is what's real. This is what's truly good. And anything that's not like this, it's not just not as good. It's not bad. It's falsehood. It's what is it? Right? Torah gives you that clarity. So now you understand. Adam Kiyomus Bo, you have to toil so hard in your Torah learning to the point that you die. Because, you know, the portal down is the portal back up. Right? When we detached our mind, man's mind used to naturally think like the Torah before the sin of Adam, before the sin of the golden calf. We used to naturally think that way. We detached from that, and that brought mortality. So you have to be willing to learn yourself to death to pull yourself out. That's how you have to learn Torah. Right? And that's why you have to toil in Torah. Right? Between us. I mean, you know, it's amazing. Why do I have to explain this? You know, I have to explain this even to the most religious Jews, right? You know, I have to explain to them what's wrong with the art scroll Gemara, right? Look, if it would have been a good idea, Rashi would have done it. The Rambam would have done it, right? Right. And I'll tell you why. Because the Gemara is not just, it's our mental gym to build our mental muscles. And it was purposely left in this dialectical form, right, to show us why this is necessarily the truth, and you can't say otherwise. So I don't understand why our parents, you know, or our teachers, you know, if we use the Cliff Notes, what is it? Somebody called now Spark. Is it called Spark Notes now?
Chegg.
What?
Chegg.
It's called. You know, you get all these things, you know, all the Shakespeare stuff, you know, in like three pages with pictures. Come on, what's that thing called? We all used it in high school. Come on.
Yeah, Spark Notes.
Well, it was back in my day, it was called Monarch Notes, Cliff Notes, you know, whatever. Okay. Whatever. Yeah, that's horrible. You got to do it the hard way. Right? I don't know. Is that true? Is that true? Do you really have to do it the hard way? Right? Is there any real reason between us? You know, that you can't take out one physics for dummies, 1, 2, and 3, and use it before your test and you know, ace your test? Is there anything morally wrong with that? Yeah, but here's the thing. If it's just the raw facts, especially if it's the facts that may not even be true, but your crackpot professor wants to hear, right? There's nothing wrong with it, right? But I'll tell you why, you know, the cheat Gemaras, the article Gemara, is a bad thing, right? Because we need the toil in Torah to change our minds, train our minds, train. We need that toil, you know, to shake off the rust, shake off the dust. Right? And because we need to change our, Torah is meant to change our thinking. It's not just information we're supposed to memorize. It's supposed to change our thinking. And the Talmud Bavli is the tool that we've used to train the mind to discern truth and have the argumentative skills to root out falsehood. It's not something they should make into a comic book. Right? It has to be hard. And even though Rashi wrote and wrote and wrote, he wouldn't write a commentary that would make Gemara easy. Right? You know, a very partial commentary for just certain background knowledge that you need. Right? Because sometimes Gemara, you know, assumes certain background knowledge, but he didn't take all the toil out of it. Right? The Rambam didn't even go there. He just wrote up his law for those who can't learn Talmud. Because it was always meant to be, you know, where we, you know, grind the mind, you know, to sharpen it. Right? Because we have to know the way we naturally think. We have to assume error, The way we naturally think, we have to assume that it's corrupted, right? And we have to toil, and that's why there's a halacha that there isn't, you know, by any other discipline. The halacha of amelus patar, you have to toil in your learning. And that's referred to, again, by Parah Aduma. You want to get out of being mortal, you have to change your perceptions. Because the mortality comes from the, you know, defaulted perception. So yamis atzu b'lashon Torah, it brought you death, kill yourself learning, that type of toil, and it'll bring you back. It's your gateway to get into the pure way of Torah thought. If you put Torah information in a corrupted mind, it comes out corrupted, right? Now, a person, you know, speaking of Reb Chaim, Reb Chaim Knievsky is also another famous, there are a few famous Reb Chaims, right? One of those Reb Chaim Soloveitch, Reb Chaim Brisker, that gave us the modern way that we learn. That's also, God forbid, it's been put into comic book form, but you know, in its day, 100 years ago, it was like the cutting edge of a new intellectual approach, right? So once a person of adulterated Jewish values, but a well-known speaker, came to his, you know, his place in Brisk, and he wanted to address the congregation. And he said, "I'll do it for free, no speaker's fees." He was a very, you know, accomplished, you know, a speaker. You know, very charismatic, you know, very passionate speaker, but, you know, he had corrupted values. So I said, "I can't let you speak to my congregation. You're corrupt." He said, "But all I do is quote from the Talmud and the Midrash, all just plain sources that me and you both agree on." So Reb Chaim said something very interesting. He said, "Yeah, but if you put kosher food in a treif pot and you cook it, it becomes treif. Right? Your pot is treif, right? Right? And that's it. That's why toil in Torah is so necessary, because every time you learn Torah, it should not just be to add information. It should be changing the way you think. That new information is that, you know, I want to think the way the Torah thinks. If you come across a Torah value, right, you don't say, that's so out of touch. You know, if the Torah feels that way about it, I want to feel that way about it." And that's why the toil in Torah is a necessary exercise. It's about negating self and negating your preconceived notions and adopting the way the Torah thinks and the way the Torah feels, right? So going back to Rav Chaim Knievsky, you know, if you want to say about that man, the man was all Torah, you know, and even if he mastered the whole Torah, he never showed himself any mercy until his end of his 90-some-odd years, learned for 17 hours a day, right? And that explains something. You know, Chazal says, "B'choyim nechadash." Every time you learn Torah, it should look like new, right? How can it look like new? The answer is because every time you learn Torah, your perceptions should be changing. So even though you saw that verse one time before, you saw that passage a time before, yeah, but you're now, after you learned it last time, your perceptions should be different. You're ready to see something new in it. This thing, it sounds like, you know, just like make-believe or self-deception if your perceptions aren't perpetually changing. But if your perceptions and feelings are perpetually changing, you will find unending, infinite depth and meaning in Torah. It just never ends, like Rav Chaim Knievsky. You know, like we said, you know, what made him so loved by the whole Jewish people was that, you know, because the Jewish people, you know, instinctively loved the Torah. And he just represented the pure Torah, not politics, you know, not activism, sorry, not any ulterior motives, but all those things, politics, you know, street smart, that type of stuff that we call being realistic. That all came into the world because of the Tree of Knowledge. None of that should have existed, this slyness, you know, this, people have said about Frank, I once saw a video of him back in 2010 in Bnei Brak, where he lived. They came up with a new generator to power the city that would be clean for any necessity of Shabbos desecration. They wouldn't need any workers, right? They came up with a totally automated system that was virtually foolproof. They had a backup on a backup on a backup, so you could really leave the main office unattended by any Jew for when Shabbos came in to when Shabbos went out. Totally safe, right? Shabbos proof, right? So they wanted him, they wanted to honor him, to activate this Shabbos-proof generator, Toby, who have totally kosher electricity on Shabbos. So they brought him in, and they put him in front of a computer console and asked him to click on the mouse, and he had no idea what he was looking at. And I said, why do you call this thing a mouse? It's not a mouse. Right? In Hebrew, also called achbar, a mouse. Why do you call it a mouse? Yeah, and he didn't know what to do. He didn't know that you have to move it, and then they had to guide him, put his hand on it, and then said, now click. He didn't know what that meant. So he had to, right? Totally, you know. Never saw a computer, saw a mouse, didn't know how to, right? And some might say, you know, people have gone to him with advice, right, for advice, and he would just say the truth, right? Well, some would say that's so not practical, that's not realistic. He is detached. But the question is, who's crazy? Right? He lived in a world of all Torah, of all MS, right? And all these things that we call about being realistic or about being street smart or politically correct, right? Or political savvy, all that shouldn't have existed in the first place, right? So yeah, who's crazy? Who's crazy? Who's reality challenged? No, besides from Jake, right? 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 This stuff, these concerns that occupy our minds and our shouldn't have existed ever. Should have existed in the first place, right? Yeah. You know, our whole religion started from one man, Avraham Avinu, right? It was him, and you know, he's called Avraham Ivri, you know, the Hebrew, but Ivri, you know what that Chazal tells us, Kol Am Me'Ever Echad, V'Avraham Rishayde, Ivri, Yashin Ever, he's on one side. It was him against the whole world. It was him against the whole world. Right? He was an idol smasher, literally. Took down all the celebs, right? So, you know, the Rambam is, again, referring to the Moreh Nevuchim in the third section, chapter 29. Look it up, because it's very inspirational. Not that we need any proof from outside sources, but the Rambam says that he saw in libraries in Egypt writings from Avraham Avinu's time, the whole story of Avraham Avinu from his enemy's perspective, the Chava people. Says he read it with his own eyes, and this is what he writes in what he read there. Again, section 3, chapter 29. That they tell a story about the radical, the rebel, the hater, Abraham, right? Who rejected everything we taught, right? And we reasoned with him, right? They were sun worshippers, the Chabad people. So listen, it's very simple, Abraham. You know, the sun, right? Big ball in the sky. It's very big, right? It gives us light. It gives us heat. It makes things grow. You know, we're just following the science, right? So that's right. So we worship the sun. Simple, right? And he says, and he told us this thing, this crazy argument. I'm quoting from the Rambam in the way it's translated to Hebrew. Who kegarzein biyadecho? It's nothing. The sun is nothing more than an axe in the hands of the woodchopper. Right? You don't thank the axe. You don't worship the axe. The sun is, it's a tool. It's a tool in the hands of the great, you know, the great woodchopper, as it were. Just the axe in the hands of the great woodchopper. Right? And they said, they tell the whole story, how they tried to assassinate him, he escaped, and they don't tell about the miracle they threw him in front, but they talk about how they write openly how they tried to dispose of him, and it didn't work, and then in the end they had to exile him, like Lech Lecha, you know, so it gives you a little shudder, you know, the story of Avraham Avinu told from the perspective of his enemies. It was him against the whole world, his truth against theirs, right? Everyone would have said Avraham's crazy. He's the only person that says that. Right? Against the whole world following the science. Right? Right? We lost a man that was, you know, he was the sane one. He wasn't just, you know, the luminary of the generation. He was called the center of sanity. Our center of sanity. Right? Man is totally beyond, you know, everything the outside world values, everything that the outside world calls being realistic or being with the times. Right? He was with the pure Torah, and so he wasn't just our lighthouse. He was our source of sanity. So I just want to say one more point, and I really thank you for coming out at this late hour to hear me. Right? There's a book by Rav Yehuda Levi, The Kuzari. You know, it's set up as a dialogue between a rabbi and a king that was converted to Judaism, actually, talk about Russia, right? Supposedly Qajars in Asiatic Russia. Anyway, so You know, after we shut off the recording, I have my own commentary on what's going on over here, you know, in current events. But let's talk about our great responsibility. So in the dialogue, you know, there's one of the less quoted things over there, something which I haven't seen in years, right? But it just popped into my head, you know, after Rav Chaim's passing. You know, the king accuses the rabbi that, you know, back then in times of, you know, Moorish Spain, you know, the big rage that the Rambam also was fighting against was the Karoyim, the Karaites, that rejected the oral tradition. Sort of like a more modern version of the Sadducees that stuck him. But it happened in the days of the Gaonim, a guy Anan, you know, because he wasn't made exilarch, you know, because he's from the royal family, but didn't make him Reish Galut. He got really ticked, so he rebelled against rabbinic Judaism. And the Karaites, you know, it was a hot thing, you know. At the time of Rav Yehuda Halevi and in Rambam, most Jews in the world were Karaites. It was a very similar situation that we're in today, that most Jews in the world are not religious. I mean, God forbid, not Torah observant. We were in this situation before, right? Then they disappeared and we're still here. But at that time, most Jews in the world were Karaites. So the king makes a very interesting argument to the rabbi that he's debating with. And he says, it seems to me the Karaites are much more zealous about their version of Judaism than you rabbinical Jews. You guys are very complacent, you're a little bit lazy, you know. Davin in the last minion, yeah, these Karaites are very zealous, you know, whatever they say, they really keep with a tremendous passion. Right? So he gives an interesting spin to it, and he says, I'll tell you why. When there's a war raging, who's panicking and who's, you know, keeps his head on straight? The people in the outposts that are unprotected, of course, they're running for cover, they're digging trenches, you know, because they're feeling insecure. So they're very zealous because they're feeling very insecure. The people who live in the citadels, right, the heavy fortified cities or encampments, you know, they go about their day, you know, they only do what the sergeant absolutely forces them to do, right, because they feel secure. You know, we rabbinical Jews, and you say, oh, it's not right that we might be a little bit lazy, but this complacency comes from a sense of confidence that we have the truth. The Karaites don't have confidence that they have truth. So because their lack of confidence causes this, you know, they compensate for their lack of confidence with this, you know, this game, this charade of religious zealousness, because they're not really confident they have the truth. Right? You know, if Orthodoxy, we were maybe a little bit complacent and a little bit overconfident, because we had a man like Rav Chaim Kanievsky in our midst, that if we ever stray too much, he'll steer us right. He'll guide us, right? So we may have a little bit of, you know, it could have been a little bit lackadaisical because we know we had an anchor, we had a lighthouse that we can't stray too far. We lost that. And it's about time we have to get a little bit more zealous, a little more serious, a little bit, self-questioning about our sincerity and where our values are, because we lost our compass. We lost our lighthouse. We lost our anchor, right? And we have to make sure to increase our Torah study, because this man who was always learning and his Torah learning protected us, not just metaphysically, like we explained before, Rambam says, whatever you have your mind on God, that causes divine plan. He did it for us, you know, for the whole Jewish people, right? It's not just that we have it there, but yeah, he had a spillover effect on the whole generation. It was the Gadol Hador, like we explained, and we lost that. So we have to be a lot more zealous, especially in the crazy times we live with. And you guys are in the thick of it. Right? You guys are in the thick of all the schmutz, right? And all the fake ideas, you know, that are being spread, you know. This, you know, where's the tree of knowledge, you know, in the negative sense? Right here, right? In the universities, right? And you guys have to be, you know, all of us, but we all have to be a lot more zealous, you know, with and particularly increase our Torah study, but not just in quantity of the time that we spend during the week, but in intensity of what we spoke about. Every time you sit down to learn, you know, ask yourself, how does this change my perceptions? How, as a result of what I learned, in what way do I think differently? In what way do I feel differently? And make it a point of internalizing, right, the Torah's ideology and the Torah's values to make it our own. And with that, in that merit, we should see Mashiach, Tzidkenu b'mehera b'yameinu.